As a 22-year-old, Aya Shebi's voice was at the heart of the democratic revolution in Tunisia in northern Africa. Now, 10 years later, she is still committed to fighting for human rights, including gender equity here on International Women's Day.
It's a great day to celebrate, but it's a great day to remind ourselves that we should accelerate gender equality. We shouldn't wait 108 years like they're estimating now to reach gender equality if we don't really act on the policies that need to be put in place to achieve that.
Aya joined us via Zoom from Ethiopia, where we hear her perspective on a number of current topics affecting the African continent and the world at large. I'm Andrew Kaufman, and this is The Strategist, presented by the George W. Bush Presidential Center. For our International Women's Day episode, we wanted to be sure to talk to a force for progress for women and young people across the globe. And Aya Shebi is exactly that. She is a pan-African feminist, and we'll talk more in a bit about what that means, but she received the 2019 Gates Foundation Campaign Award and is the first ever African Union Special Envoy on Youth. She was a key voice in Tunisia as they fought for freedom during the Arab Spring and simply is a person who drives change. Aya, thank you so much for joining us from Ethiopia.
Thank you for having me on our podcast on Women's Day.
We're thrilled. And our co-host is Natalie Ganella-Platz, the director of the Women's Initiative at the Bush Institute. Natalie, thank you for coming back and bringing your wisdom and perspective today.
Thanks for the opportunity, Andrew. As I said before, I couldn't think of a better guest to have for International Women's Day on The Strategist this year.
So to pull the curtain back a little bit on and some behind the scenes here, when we were brainstorming guests for the season and we said, International Women's Day is March 8th. So we obviously went to Natalie, the director of our Women's Initiative, and said, hey, who should we get for International Women's Day? Like, who's going to make sense here? And without hesitating, Natalie lit up and said, do you think we can get Aya Shebi? And here we are. True story.
I'm blushing.
Well, and I think explaining why is probably a good place to start this conversation. So, Aya, you are just an incredible force for progress from Tunisia to Africa to seeking change around the world. I was wondering if you could give us a little bit about your background as a foundation. Let's get to know you for a minute. How did you find your voice? And then amplify that voice as a platform for visibility and recognition for so many others.
Even though I still feel I'm young, it seems like it's been a long way to go. I think I started when I was a child as a rebel in my family. I come from a relatively conservative religious family from the northwest of Tunisia on the Tunisian-Algerian borders, from a small village there. And to stand up for myself, you know, as 13-year-old, 14-year-old, and be like, I'm going to wear what I want. I'm going to study what I want. To go on to university and say, I'm going to live by myself. To travel even across Tunisia and then, you know, go out and travel the world was, I was the first female to do all of that in the family. And it was always perceived as radical, even though I didn't think of those as radical things to do. For me, it was, you know, I grew up with a feminist father, even though he doesn't think he's feminist, but he used his privilege as the head of the family, you know, the respected elder to just have my back. So he wouldn't agree with me necessarily, but whatever I do, he would support. And that meant a lot through my, you know, childhood and teenager years until, Tunisia's revolution. I think my rebel self, my radical voice was there all along within my family, especially being very conscious about my gender and how society treats me differently as a girl. And then I think it just matured to be a political voice during Tunisia's revolution. It was more like, instead of standing up for myself and my own struggle and the injustice I am subjected to as a young woman living in my society, now I can fight for the same thing on a bigger scale, on a political scale. And I think later on that became the Pan-African cause and then the global cause. So I think the more you connect with people from other contexts and other cultures, and you realize we have the same struggle. We have very similar experiences with different contexts. And so the more we are united in this fight, maybe the better or the faster we can achieve what we want to achieve. So I really think that that radical in me just was ready for Chinita's revolution, because when the revolution happened, I started blogging, I started, you know, going to the streets, protesting, and I did things I did not think I am capable of myself, you know, like to be fearless, you know, not give a shit about injustice in front of, you know, police state, and the courage that I had, the fearlessness that I had, I did not think I had that until it manifested in the revolution. And then when I thought about it, I'm like, no, I was courageous in many, you know, situations in the family, standing for myself in front of elders, choosing for myself what I want to do. I think it's been there all along.
Well, and what I kind of find interesting too is that this is all happening in 2011. And in the United States, then we were mostly using social media to share personal stories and pictures of our pets. Around that time, you did see the Occupy Wall Street movement here, but it didn't have anything close to the scale of what you guys were doing there in Tunisia. I mean, in many ways, you were light years ahead of us. Did you realize at the time just how powerful social media was going to be and how important it was going to be to that, to your movement and what you were trying to accomplish over there?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to brag about it, but the Tunisians were the first to turn social media into a tool for social change. You know, it was the first time ever, instead of sending you, you know, an invite to an event on Facebook, to your wedding or your graduation party, I would send you to, you know, a protest in front of the Ministry of Interior. And that's how we met each other in the revolution. I mean, I met so many people I have not known before, but because we organized in a way that I think it just brought speed to organizing. Protest, it's not something new. Every revolution in any time in history had a youth face, and young people went to the street to protest injustice. I think the difference with our revolution is that we used social media to delegitimize, you know, the regime and expose the injustice, so that people said, I remember during that time, you know, some country said, you're a troublemaker. These are troublemakers. We're going to send troops to protect, you know, the government from it. And we had to live tweet. We had to blog. We had to do, you know, citizen journalism using social media to show the world that this is our narrative. We're not troublemakers. We're standing up for ourselves. And I think that speed things up, because I remember when Barack Obama first time said, I stand with the Tunisian people and I stand with the young people of Tunisia. That changed the game of how even the reporting of international media around what's happening, you know, and that social media helped us to expose that. And then it is a very good tool of organizing to instead of people like protesting in different spaces, you have one Facebook event, everyone shows up in the same time. And, you know, masses is power. The more we are in masses, the more we scare the dictator and eventually he run away. So, I mean, social media can be really a powerful tool. I mean, it was 28 of consistent protests every day and using mobilization and exposing the information, even giving information when Egypt revolution started, we were helping them with how they deal with tear gas and how they deal with protests and what we've used, and, you know, sharing best practices on social media with other revolutionaries. I don't think that happened during the French Revolution. And back to what you said at the beginning, I mean, you said the Arab Spring, and that's something I, since 2011, when I started to travel the world and talk about the revolution, I always made sure that the Arab Spring, to say that the Arab Spring is a Western narrative. We call it the revolution of dignity. People in the West called it the Arab awakening, as if we were sleeping and we woke up overnight. No, we had mini revolution in 2006, 2007, 2008, you know, people were protesting in the mining industry. They were just crack down. And it was, I think we were just ready after all these small uprisings and revolution to have a real revolution by 2011, because I feel like it was the time we were ready. We had the tools, everyone was organized. One of the mistakes, a dictator could do is to educate their population. We were a very educated youth population, but we were unemployed. And so I think it was just the right moment and the right time for the revolution to happen.
Really, really incredible points there. And I want to come back to something that you mentioned at the start of responding to our questions, and this idea that, you know, we are so much more alike than we are different. And this is true everywhere. I mean, it's a universal truth. Our humanity is what connects us. Unfortunately, you know, in the last decade, social media and digital access in many ways has been used to divide rather than unite. But, you know, there are some incredible examples across the continent of Africa, like Shut It All Down recently, where social media, digital connectedness, driven largely by young people, has really served as a catalyst for unity and a catalyst for change. And could you talk a little bit more about that? And obviously we touched on sort of how social media was used a decade ago, but how does that continue and how has that grown today? And what can people really learn from it and how they approach their own digital presence?
Right. The everything digital can be used for good or can be used to divide, can be used to unite or used to divide, for sure. I mean, even during the revolution, quickly the regime started to pick up on social media and create their own Facebook pages and start to infiltrate and so on. So I think the social media has also been for us an awakening, that when people start to say it's a Facebook revolution or it's a Twitter revolution, whatever, we were saying that it's a tool. The work on the ground, the people who stand up in a protest are willing to die for freedom, willing to sacrifice themselves for other generations to live with freedom and dignity. That's the revolution, you know, but the social media is just a tool to accelerate that process. So I think we always need to be reminded that of community organizing and of on the ground organizing. I think our generation just came up with innovative tools to use them to organize, and a lot of platforms that came out after that really helped also organize ourselves across borders, across countries, not only within our countries. So Tunisia revolution, you know, inspired Egypt even before, you know, people called it the Arab Spring because they saw Syria happen, Yemen happen, all of that. Even before all of that, it was an African revolution, because right a week after Tunisia, Senegal started to protest, Senegalese youth, Younama movement, raising the same slogan as Tunisia, Degage, which is leave. Burkina Faso youth started to protest. And then Fees Must Fall happened in South Africa. And then, as you said, a decade after, we see End SARS in Nigeria and Shut It All Down in Namibia. So, you know, and globally, you know, Black Lives Matter and Occupy movement, and also in 2011, 2012. So I think it was just like, maybe we could take credit of exposing new ways of organizing, new ways of activism, new ways of doing things, that the world just took it and ran with it. And it really shows that there was a lot of anger and frustration everywhere. But now we could see it because of social media, because anywhere you are in the world, you can see what's happening in the other country. But that doesn't mean there aren't problems in each of our countries. And I think the second thing, even, you know, the Me Too movement and all of that. The second thing is the global solidarity. Once, you know, a hashtag becomes something I identify with as a Tunisian, someone in Ghana identify with, someone in Belarus identify with, then it becomes a global struggle. And I think that's the power of how to use social media for social change. When you're able to mobilize people and unite them around a cause that they identify with and they resonate with, to be able to put that hashtag in whatever status I have, it means it speaks to me. Now, on the other hand of, you know, social media, we need to realize that Africa is 70% offline. And they say in history that it's only 10% of the population that does a revolution. And yes, the 10% in each of our African countries that does the revolution is the people who have access to digital space. is the elite, right? Even those who, you know, might have access in the most marginalized areas, it's still a privilege compared to other young people who are, you know, migrants, refugee, displaced. So we need to also realize that even though it is a powerful thing for the West and for Global North, it's a very privilege in Africa. Even this whole pandemic showed us how, the most people who got out of jobs and who lost their jobs in education are in Africa because we don't have digital infrastructure. And I think also people in the United States need to realize the power they have with the digital means. And we even have conversations with our diaspora to say, you know, you actually can set the narrative there, because by the time we wake up, the news becomes trends in the United States, because you have access to that news. You trend the hashtag already. We wake up to those news, and then that becomes, you know, the debate in Africa. And I think what people in other countries, that richer countries that have this privilege of digital space, need to think about the power they really have through social media, through digital tools, through technology that they can use for social movements and to really make an impact. And I think the more maybe in Africa we would have access to digital space, you will see more revolutions happening. You will see more young people democratizing government. You will see more innovations taking place. So whatever you see right now, bear in mind that it's only 30% access. Imagine if we had, you know, 90% or 80%, what kind of power we could show. And I think that to me shows how powerful African youth are, you know, and young people who are in these oppressed regimes, oppressed circumstances and settings and marginalized settings. Even with the hardships we have, even with the lack of access we have, we're standing up for our rights. We are not giving up, you know? And I think that is a message we want to send to the world, that if you have access, if you have a constitution like the United States that provides you the freedoms, you know, you can exercise, then take advantage of that.
So it is International Women's Day, and I want to make sure our audience understands some of the differences in our societies. You touched on it early on, that your father was a feminist who supported you, but you were still a rebel, especially for women. So can you touch on how society treated women in Tunisia in 2011 versus how women are treated today in 2021 versus where you hope it will be in the future?
So when I was, between 9 years old and 12 years old, I don't even remember the exact age, but I was subjected to this practice called tasfih, where it claims to protect women's virginity. And so it's a practice that me and my female cousins go through. They scratch our knees and they do some ritual. And that means now your virginity is protected and you can only, you know, when you get married, you lift this spell. And it's a whole trauma thing, right? And I think that was the moment I realized, oh my God, so I am going through this just because I'm a female. I think and you have to do it before you get your period. So imagine at that age, I'm starting to just open up to the idea of my gender. And I think from there, then you start facing society in school, later on in university, in the streets, in the transport, in the bus, you start getting, subjected to sexual harassment. You start getting being discriminated because of your gender, whether when you're seeking a job or in the school when you are in a math class and you raise your hand and they pick the boy. You know, all of these things that you go through and you start asking yourself, wow, this is happening for the mere fact that I am a female. And I say it in contrast with what I'm an only child. I've been raised as an only child. So I have only my father and my mother. My father is a military guy. He's been in the army for 40 years. My mom is housewife. So I've been raised in that context, but with a father who tells me that you can be whatever you want to be. And while my mom is trying to get me married as soon as possible, you know, because for her, the train passed and I'm old now to get married. While my mom, you know, because she also grew up in the constructed, you know, patriarchal system of telling her this is what a woman should do, you know, get a degree, get married, have children and all of that. My father, on the other hand, was just pushing me to finish my education. Even when I took time during the revolution for 4 years between my undergrad, I actually graduated my undergrad with the revolution year. I don't even know how I graduated in that crazy year. But then I decided to go on in the democratic transition to serve my country. And then he kept pushing me until I went back to do my master's, you know, in 2015. And then he's like pushing for PhD and so on. So his focus was more, I want you to dream. I want you to fulfill your dream, your goals, whatever you want. You know, marriage is not an achievement. So I think that's why I think my father is a feminist, even though we disagree on other things, especially political positions. But still, he is someone who has raised a daughter who believes that she has equal chances in the world as her male counterparts. And I think that's very important to be raised in a family like that, especially when the father is like that, because you see, you know, other men, you know, thinking and behaving and acting in a very misogynist and sexist and patriarchal way, why you grow up with such a feminist father. So I think that's what I meant by saying that. But in terms of the situation or the state of women today, yeah, since we are talking about Women's Day, I think we need more and more intergenerational conversations and collaboration, because when I sit with my elders, I ask them what kind of violent world you're leaving for us. You know, what does it justify until now in 2021 for girls to be genitally mutilated, for girls to drop out of school because of their periods, for me to be to feel silenced or invisible just because I'm a female, or to be paid less for doing my job and even more, you know? So it's still, with all the achievements that have been made, you know, the past decades and decades, and of course they broke a lot of glass ceilings. It's amazing. The World Trade Organization had the first African woman in history. But I just wonder why it took 60 years, 100 years, 200 years, you know, what happened? You know, I would have imagined with an age of, you know, artificial intelligence, an age of where we live today, to have been more progressive in our human rights too. You know, as progressive we want to get with our economies and with our technology, and we want, you know, with the space on our human values and where we want to go as equal humans. And that frustrates me. So as much as I'm very grateful as a young woman to have been able to also, you know, crack my own ceilings through leadership spaces and where I have arrived today, whether the African Union, the revolution, my country, my continent, I still believe that we are in the exception, and we shouldn't be. It should be the mainstream that young females can be in leadership. I shouldn't be the only young female in intergovernmental space. And that frustrates me. So it's a great day to celebrate, but it's a great day to remind ourselves that we should accelerate gender equality. We shouldn't wait 108 years like they're estimating now to reach gender equality if we don't really act on the policies that need to be put in place to achieve that.
Hear, hear. And, you know, for us here at the Bush Institute, we focus a lot on both the systems change and the social change that needs to happen. And when it comes to gender equity specifically, you know, thinking about concepts like agency, and it's not that women and girls don't lack agency, it's that our societies don't acknowledge, protect, and respect that agency and the ability each of us should have to decide and act on our choices. And, you know, things like access and active participation are equally crucial. So in your view, what really stands out, both in the context of the African context, but globally, what needs to happen to get us to a better state of equal? And I'm going to make that question a little more complicated. Knowing what we know about COVID-19 and the economic fallout, not only felt on a regional level, but also on a gender level, why has this cause become so much more important today?
No, absolutely. I mean, when you said agency, it's such an important word and concept. And I get really frustrated with these kind of words that, the society, the civil society as well contributed to it, the media and all of that, the voice of the voiceless, as if someone else doesn't have a voice and I'm speaking for them. But when we are in spaces of leadership and advocacy spaces, we're not speaking on behalf of people. We are just amplifying what is happening on the ground, what is happening to the constituency we have access to. And I think that needs to be strengthened, because not, like you said, not putting agency in the hands of the people who experience it the most, whether it's women, whether it's refugees, whether whoever is the community, they actually know best the problem. They have the solution. All you need to do as a mayor or as a policymaker or whatever, just go and have a listen, just listen. And that's what we always ask for as young people. Just listen. I mean, how many revolution we can do until you take us seriously? But I think in terms of what needs to be done, first of all, I think the women movement, the feminist movement, need to be intergenerational, because they were feminist movements across different generations that had different strategies, that had different tactics, that, had different gains. But we don't have that intergenerational learning, intergenerational collaboration, even intergenerational healing. Like what happened to my mother and grandmother and what's happening to me today? We don't, unfortunately, have those conversations. So if the feminist movement will really survive and will really get stronger, it must be intergenerational. The issues we talk about today as young women by ourselves, and then we go to another space and talk about them, it's like we're talking different language, and it shouldn't be. And I think the more we have that intergenerational co-leadership and collaboration, the movement would get stronger. The second thing, the movement should be Pan-African. And by Pan-Africanism, I don't just mean African, because Pan-Africanism means Ubuntu. And Ubuntu means I am because of who we all are. Which means when you protest as Black Lives Matter in the US and you win that fight, it means I win that fight in my country too. Because we're fighting for the same thing. We're fighting for justice. We're fighting for dignity. So it's the concept of your liberation is my liberation. And that concept came in Africa. Why? Because Africa was colonized. And I think 1960, 10 African countries got independence in 1 year. It's not because the colonizer woke up and decided one day I'm going to free all these countries. No, because the leaders organized across borders and said, I'm not going to sign this liberation deal, as Ghana if Tunisia is not liberated. I'm not going to sign this deal in Tanzania if South Africa is not liberated. So that, I think, concept of Pan-Africanism, of Ubuntu, of our collective liberation needs to be at the heart of the feminist women movement. And I think that will take away all these conversations about, global North and global South and our different fights in the feminist movement and feminism with an S, because we have different understanding of feminism. I think once we start thinking of our movement as global and as Pan-African, then that would strengthen, the results that we would get in hopefully, by the end of this decade. Though we said 2030 global goals, right? That's what we're aiming for, not more than that. And I think the third thing we really need to do is we really need to use strategically and smartly the partnership or collaboration between where our influence is. Because, for example, when I went into the African Union, that's an intergovernmental space, but I come from civil society. And I had that credibility with the youth base, my constituency in Africa, and that helped that they mobilize in civil society. I mobilize in the intergovernmental space. We, bring the young entrepreneurs to also be part of the conversations. We bring different communities. And I think in the multilateral system right now, this is a conversation happening a lot with COVID, it's failing and it's breaking. And I'm afraid that our movements will fall into that as well. And it will become, no, this is only the civil society movement, or this is, no, this is only, you know, the policymakers table to decide on gender equality, or this is only, you know, this agency. So I feel that in our movement as well, we have to be collaborative, we have to be intersectional. Even though it's a feminist movement, we shouldn't adopt masculinity of like competition, you know, because competition is also comes from this capitalist understanding of the survival of the fittest and all of that. So to me, it's so important that our movement is Pan-African, is collaborative, is intergenerational, is intersectional. And until we have that, we need to work much harder to speak to each other and to start mobilizing towards it.
You know, I think I think I'm guilty as an American of when I think of Africa, I think of this one place. But really, it's you know, an incredibly rich and diverse continent with, you know, so many different viewpoints and people. And could you talk a little bit about the Pan-African movement and what it's trying to accomplish, and how it balances that perception of working together, but also still maintaining these differences that have such a rich history, and that aren't they're not bad differences, they're just differences.
Yeah, I think it's a global issue right now that we do not accept the other who is different from us, whatever that difference is. And I think I grew up with a lot of sense of diversity, first because I come from Tunisia, and Tunisia is just a mosaic of diversity. Because of my father's work in the army, we used to move to a different city every 2 years. So I studied probably in 5 or 6 different schools. And from north to west to south of Tunisia, I've seen different dialects we speak, different shades of our colors. We're not one. And even like our indigenous language, Amazigh, when I went to the south and suddenly I discovered, oh, actually we were colonized by the Arabs and now this is not my language, you know? And then, you know, other people in, you know, other African countries would think of North Africa is like Arab and white. And then you find Black Tunisians and they're like surprised, like how? So there is, in the world that is very interconnected today and there is very multicultural, I think it's naive to think that in one country even, or even in one community, that we all the same, we look the same, we think the same, or we have the same, you know, whether it's a religion, faith, sexual orientation, whatever it is. So it's a bit of a global issue, this looking at diversity as a threat rather than something that is very rich. And I grew up with that sense that I'm very rich. I'm Mediterranean, I'm African, I'm Maghrebian, I can speak 3 different languages. So wherever I go on the continent, I feel home. And I have, I'm born Muslim. I have a Muslim background. So I go to Senegal and I go and sit with people and break the fast. You know, I go to Mombasa. They speak Swahili. It's almost like Arabic, you know. And I go to any Francophone country and we have a conversation. So to me, I've always seen my diversity as my power, actually. And where I am now, and maybe my even ability to organize a Pan-African movement, a youth movement, a couple of years ago, Africa Youth Movement, was also that ability to, you know, show my diversity, be proud of my diversity, and use my diversity to even organize. Because the more you tap into your own diversity, you realize that you connect to different communities around the world, not only in your country or your community. So the Pan-African movement, back to your question, I think what we want to achieve as young people in Africa is to take charge of our own destiny. The average age of African leaders on the continent is 64 years old. The average age of the population is 19.5, almost 20 years old. We have 40 years of generation gap. It doesn't make any sense. And I feel that we spent the past decade protesting. We went to the street. At least 30 African countries went to the street to protest. it's not giving us the results we want. We ran for office, you know, Bobby Wine just was running for president. He's probably the youngest person on the continent who ran for a presidential election. We know that he won it and it was rigged and we couldn't win. So it means in this Pan-African movement, we need to re-strategize our tools and our goals and how we want to reach there, because what we have done the past decade is not working. And why I think Pan-Africanism as an ideology is the way to go, because if we were all as young people behind Bobby Wine when he ran for office, we probably could have changed the game, you know, if we were an organized Pan-African youth movement. So I want us to reach that point where we are so organized, so united as a continent, that when one young person stands up in one place, we all are behind and we win all together. Because when he wins in Uganda, the next would be Tunisia, the next would be Zimbabwe, the next would be Namibia, or wherever. And I think for me, you know, this is a dream I live for, and I hope to achieve it in my lifetime. I also want to say that it also saddens me when, especially that we're talking about women, that when we do these revolutions, you know, we all on the streets, right? We all risk our lives. You see the pictures of all the revolutions happened in Africa. You see a young face and you see young women faces on the front line. And then when, you know, Bin Ali left, you know, when Mubarak was imprisoned, when all these guys went down, you know, now the old men come in and say, good job. Now we know politics and we understand how politics work. And all of us find out ourselves out, you know, there is no place for young women in leadership. There is no place for women in leadership after women were with you on the front line to make change. And I think that is a big issue. That happened in independence days. There is no documentation of women who were, you know, on the front line of the revolution movement. We only remember, you know, what would you think about in the United States when you think of liberation in Africa? Lumumba or Kwame Nkrumah or Kenyatta or, you know, Mandela, you know, all of these names you think about, it's men, because we do the struggle together, we win together, and then we're, you know, when we win, the cake becomes very, very small. The piece of women is like, if there is at all, one bite for us.
No, it's so true. And we've been talking a lot about this lately across our team, this idea of a bit of a democracy paradox, right? Like, even in some of the oldest and most resilient democracies, though democracy is hard and you have to work on it every day, that's, there's this paradox that women are still left behind in terms of representation, in terms of protection through rule of law. You know, you look worldwide and only 24% of parliamentarians are women. And that's not even breaking it down in looking at sort of age disaggregated demographics. So, you know, this is a challenge that's universal. It's not unique to any one place around the globe, but something we all have to work really hard to overcome and to assure that our societies are representative of the full spectrum of the people within them. And I mean, women and girls are half the population, you know? So it's really important that our leadership reflects that and protects the needs and the rights and the agency of women everywhere. With that in mind, I want to talk a little bit about, you've just come to the end of your tenure as the youth envoy to the AU. You know, what projects are on the horizon? What are you hoping to really dig into this year? And as you look to the next decade ahead?
Yeah, I mean, I look forward first to a long, long vacation and a break, because the past 2 years has been a marathon. I mean, it's been literally a marathon. I don't remember the days I really had a good sleep in those past 2 years. I think because of the responsibility that I'm the first and I'm building the foundation for what this office would offer. But also I learned a lot from the intergovernmental space. You know, I came from civil society. I went into bureaucracy and memos, talking to member states, you know, diplomacy. I feel now I am more of value to activism than I was before, because before I was, you know, radical, noisy activist against status quo and establishment and, you know, all the old people go out and we're going to take charge. But now, I mean, after those 2 years and understanding the policy space, understanding the tools of advocacy, you know, and how to navigate them, I feel that there is a lot of things we could do now in the activism space and new ways of doing that we can reach where we want to go. And I feel I want to serve in that capacity to really support youth movements, women movements, social movements who are passionate about social change, who do stand up for their rights and their communities, but who don't have access. And sometimes it's just a gap of information about the intergovernmental space, the policy space, and what's happening. And I feel I could be that bridge. And I feel also I could be now more of a bridge between the elder and the young generation, because I've seen from my 2 years that because I promoted this idea of intergenerational co-leadership, a lot of young people also now trust the African Union better as an institution. You know, a lot of young people engage in the African Union now more as an institution. And I feel that the more we can connect or bridge the generations, the more actually we bridge the youth with the institutions, because sadly, the institutions right now are led by old men. So it's a fact. And I think the more we bring young people in masses within the system, as much as in masses in the streets, I think we could reach where we want to go better. So I hope to support those efforts and to play my part. I have launched 2 years ago a project called AfriZist, which is documenting youth movements across the continent from an African perspective. But also providing youth trainings and curriculum from an Afrocentric perspective, basically learning from our ways of organizing indigenous knowledge and experiences, and trying to equip the young activists with that kind of knowledge, but also making sure that these movements are documented from a youth perspective, from an African perspective, so we don't end up with names like Arab Spring and Arab Awakening, but that we name our own movements, and that is the narrative, and we set, you know, the standard for that, and really write our own history. So I'm going to pick up on AfriZist to continue training young activists and hopefully do more documentation. And you know, when I saw NSARS in Nigeria, the first thing I thought about, because it's already a decade since Tunisia's revolution, it's like from Tunisia to Nigeria, like what happened? Because the young people who were in Nigeria, they're not even millennials, they're younger than me. And really to understand the evolution of our movement is fascinating to me. And it's going to be a missed opportunity if we don't really document that learning and what our generation has been able to do.
So on a completely different topic, we've hardly touched on the biggest thing that's happening on the entire planet right now, and you're actively involved there. You're on the board of the Independent Pandemic Preparedness Council. We'd love to hear your thoughts on what's happening right now in your region and what your hopes are for what's next, both in the short term and in the long term.
I think COVID-19 for Africa was not only a health crisis. It's still a governance crisis, an enormous economic crisis. Even before the pandemic, Africa, you know, is really struggling to answer to the crisis and emergency of youth employment. We're supposed to provide 12 million jobs every year and to our, you know, youthful population, and we provide only 3 million, which are formal jobs. But the reality is 60% of our population is in. So I think that they're hit with is really their livelihoods rather than the COVID-19 as a virus. So a young person would say, it's same for me to die in the 19, because, you know, my basic right. And I think that's where we felt it most. Obviously, in our countries, we have very fragile healthcare systems. And so the governance crisis was really exacerbated. And with all of that, I have to say, we have shown amazing leadership. I mean, the way we dealt with it in solidarity, I remember when the first case was detected in Egypt on 14th of February, the African Union called for all health ministers to convene in Addis Ababa, and 30 of them showed up, and they all agreed on one, joint strategy, continental joint strategy. They established a joint task force. And from there, for Africa, it has always been, as a continent, how are we going to beat this pandemic? It's never been my country or your country. And I think Africa has really shown great leadership in that. And maybe, when people ask, like, Africa is one of the continents that has the least rates of infection and death. But I think part of it is really how we stood up together as a continent in solidarity, and we acted as one. Even now with the vaccine rollout, we are acting as one. We're building one platform. The distribution even of test kits, even last year of test kits and masks has been always as a continent. The chairperson of the African Union mobilized. Things come here to Addis and then get distributed based on, member states putting their needs in. The summary of what has been happening in Africa, we are really hit the most economically. We are really hit the most because our systems have not been prepared and ready. Probably that's something also the international systems have not been prepared and ready, even though we thought maybe other countries could be. Because of our youthful population, we are more than 50%. We're 65% under the age of 30. It's really hit economically. But on the other hand, I think the summary of the story is that when you have a unity of vision, when you beat a pandemic or any crisis as one, and you put aside your whatever personal interest and you think of my tiny country and your country and all that individualistic approach to things actually work. So, when we say to the multilateral system that you need to do it this way, we're not just trying to tell them that try it out or experiment, maybe it will work. No, we're telling them it actually works. Look at Africa and how things work. Everything goes through Pan-African distribution platforms. Everything goes through member states coming together. The last AU summit happened just a few months ago. And so I think that is a good lesson for the world from Africa. I think the world can learn a lot from the continent and how the continent handled the pandemic. It can learn a lot also from community engagement, because we have the experience of dealing with Ebola. And in Ebola outbreak, there was a lot of building community workers, training community workers, building community engagement, engaging religious leaders, chiefs, community leaders. We already had the experience. So when we were hit with COVID, we were very alert. We reacted immediately, responded immediately. And I think not blame, but what we say now about the international system is that they were delay in response. There was a response at the end, but that delay in response between the alarm when it hit and between what happened actually as mechanisms, that was the delay, and that lost a lot of lives. That resulted in the loss of a lot of lives. When you have an emergency, you have to act immediately. And I think that's something Africa did. Called immediately for a joint effort and for the continent to stand up and beat this pandemic as a continent.
Thank you, Aya. This was absolutely incredible. And just your impact from Tunisia to across the continent of Africa is really a testament to the capacity each of us has to make a difference, but more importantly, the vital influence of collaboration and partnership towards a common goal. And I'm really excited to see where you continue to push and make our society better. And, you know, we obviously share so many mutual areas of interest. I'm utterly thrilled that we were able to engage you for this Strategist episode to commemorate International Women's Day this year.
So everybody, make sure to follow Aya Shebi on social media. She's got really just interesting perspective from that side of the world. Follow her at Aya Shebi, AYA_CHEBBI. That's Instagram, Twitter, and also her website, ayashebi.com. Aya, thank you so much for spending the time with us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Thank you all for listening.